Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hey, it's Anna. I want to let you know that in this episode, I talk with Margot Price about losing a child soon after childbirth. If that's not something you want to listen to right now, you might want to skip this one.
I thought, you know, this is karma and I deserve this, but he doesn't. My son didn't.
This is Death, Sex, and Money. The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. Margot Price was nominated for a Best New Artist Grammy in 2018, 15 years after she moved to Nashville when she was 20. This year, Margot turns 40, and her new album starts with the song Bend to the Mountain, where she writes about the jagged path of her musical career and her different personas. They've included a classic country songstress, the female lead of an all-dude rock band, and a solo artist who turns up her own amp.
Used to be a lover, queen and a drifter, a cowboy devil, a bride and a boxer, a pilgrim and a thief, but it was me underneath. I just know who I'm at, then that's all right with me, all right.
When Margot and I spoke, she was at her home outside Nashville, where she lives with her kids and her husband, musician Jeremy Ivey. It was a rare moment of quiet.
Well, my children are at school.
Uh-huh.
My husband is outside with a chainsaw chopping up a tree that fell in our yard. And I am just kind of in our little den here. We have a kind of a makeshift recording studio, music room. It's connected to our laundry room and it's where my cats hang out.
It sounds cozy and sordid. The life of a musician who has made it after years of uncertainty. Like the central question of her memoir, which she called Maybe We'll Make It, has been answered. But this is actually a time of major upheaval for Margot, one of the biggest during her nearly 20-year relationship with her husband. In large part, she says, because she gave up alcohol 2 years ago.
It's been really the most challenging thing that we have went through since we have lost a child.
Their child, Ezra, died a few days after he was born. He was a twin. His brother, Judah, is now 12, and they also have a 3-year-old, Ramona. Back when Margot was about Ramona's age, she was going through the first big upheaval of her life.
Times, they were tough.
up at home. My daddy lost the farm when I was 2 years old. Took a job at the prison, working second shift. And that's the last time I'll let them take what should be his.
I want to go back to when you were a kid, to another transition, and when you were really little, when your family and your extended family lost the farm that they had worked. How many generations had that farm been in your family?
You know, I think my dad would have been the fourth.
Margot's family lost their farm in Illinois in the mid-1980s. They couldn't cover their debt payments and keep the farm running. For them, it was a new grain silo they'd had to build with borrowed money. But thousands of farms also went under in the U.S. during this time, as interest rates went up and the price of major farm crops collapsed.
There was just such a sense of shame around it. And even now, some of my uncles and some of my family back home, it's like they just prefer that I just shut my mouth and not talk about it. It was always there. It was the elephant in the room for sure. And there were a lot of elephants in the room. That wasn't the only thing that it affected. You know, I don't think a lot of their mental health was being taken care of. I think there was a lot of stuff that was really swept under the rug. And that is kind of still how a lot of my family is today. It's like, just put on a smile and pretend like it's not happening. Just like, what did Kurt Cobain say? A denial.
Do you think of, like, for your family, was losing the farm and that betrayal by the system, by the bank, did it create a sort of sense of, like, screw it, just do what you love and try it? Because this system isn't built to help people like us succeed?
Oh, without a doubt. I think I always say there's a lot of similarities kind of in farming and in being a musician, because it is a path that is kind of paved with uncertainties. But I also saw that you could work your whole life building something and that it could just slip through your hands, you know, within seconds. And I think that all probably started my distrust and my disdain for authority, for the government, for politicians, for all of it.
When you were first drinking as a teenager, like, how did you, like, when you were going out, what did you learn about how you were as a drinker?
Well, I felt like it was the ultimate rebellion. I did not feel very popular many times in my youth, and I wanted to, to be well-liked and to be funny. But I just loved it. It gave me confidence. People would talk about how wild I was the night before and, you know, how I was this character in a book or in a movie.
Oh, a character. Like what kind of character? Like fun? Like the one that was sort of like the middle of the action?
Kind of like, yeah, being everybody's entertainment, like a bit of a protagonist where it was like, oh, you never knew what she was going to do. I started building that that persona very young. And so that was why it was incredibly difficult to eradicate from my life, because it was just so deeply ingrained in my personality. I had really worked hard to become the bad girl and to, I think even when I go back and I look at my early press cycles, it was always like country badass, American badass. Like, you know, I was so tough because I could just hold my own and just keep up with the men.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's interesting that you think of it as a way of rebelling, because it sounds like another thing you mentioned in your book is when you started drinking, people commented that you could hold your alcohol like a price, like it was something that was part of your family culture, like your parents liked to party too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was something that I'd always kind of seen modeled to me. It's like, if you needed to relax, if you needed to blow off steam, then that was the way to do it.
Alcohol was also around a lot when Margo arrived in Nashville after dropping out of college. There were shift drinks at her waitressing jobs, boozy open mics, and lots of parties with fellow musicians. That's where she met her husband, Jeremy. They were both young and pretty new to town, and sparks flew between them romantically and creatively.
It was all the emotions, like, of just, you know, really intense love, but also passion for all the same things. And, you know, a lot of competitiveness as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what was that like?
I think it was mostly healthy in the early days. It would be like, if he wrote a song, then I would have to sit down and try to write one that was way better. And then... No, we'd always be like, the ultimate compliment would be like, oh, I'm so jealous. I wish I wrote that song. And we definitely, once we started working together more, it was really cool because it was like, okay, now we have a band. We are teammates. We are like, you know, compatriots. And it's us against the world. It was just so nice to have somebody in my corner.
Do you think that, like, when you think about the early years of your career, when you both were living hand to mouth, you know, working jobs for wages, then selling all your stuff, then hitting the road, then coming back, did it feel in a certain way like that teaming up with him gave you permission to take more risks? Because you had like a partner in living a sort of very tenuous life?
Yeah, I think, you know, him and I, we knew at times that our parents would be worried about us or that they wouldn't approve of, you know, where we were living, if it was a place of squalor or, whatever it was. If it was me deciding that I was going to dye my hair almost black and grow out my armpit hair. And, you know, I knew, like, that's really going to make my mom upset. But he would be like, I love your armpit hair. Your hair can be whatever color you want. And he was still there for me, you know, and vice versa. He has very religious parents. They're beautiful people and they've softened a lot in their older age. But, they were always kind of coming to preach to us and tell us, like, we better get right with God or we were going to hell. And we were like, hey, well, at least we're going to hell together.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like growing up in a town where it felt like you didn't always feel comfortable and it felt ill-fitting to find somebody who could cheer you on as you, like, tried on different realities. It sounds like it must have felt really fun.
Yeah, it was. I look back on those days with a lot of fondness. And, you know, I think when we were in it and when we were living it, there was a lot of embarrassment and shame because people from our hometowns were just like graduating from college and getting great jobs and having children and weddings and, you know, buying the nice house and having the nice car. And we were, you know, at times we didn't even have enough money to make rent, or we would, you know, didn't have enough money to buy groceries. And we were just like determined to be some kind of like anarchist version of ourselves. And we really lived in this kind of bubble that was maybe a little bit of a denial ourselves into how bad it was or what was going on. But to me and to Jeremy, I know it was just like, well, this is just going to fuel the art and give us more fodder and for the, for the songs, for the music.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the idea of something that is going to fuel the art can be an excuse for a lot of bad behavior. This is good for our creative juices.
Oh, yeah. That old myth.
Coming up, Margot talks about the death of her son Ezra, days after she and Jeremy first became parents.
And then, yeah, I just got blackout drunk because that was the only way that, again, I was taught how to cope with anything.
A few weeks ago, we asked you to share your current dilemmas about fear, to tell us about the things that you're afraid of or have been putting off, even though you really want to do them. Some of you have already responded to share your fears around some big life decisions, whether or not to have kids, to get married, to leave your job. Thank you for sharing these questions, and we'd love to keep hearing from more of you. No fear is too big or too small. Maybe you want to try something new, like running a marathon, but it feels too hard to try. Or maybe you want to go skydiving, even though you're afraid of heights. Or maybe you're thinking about a dramatic life change and you seize up with panic when you think about carrying it out, but you can't figure out if that's your fear or your intuition talking. How do you know which fears to listen to and which ones to push through? We're putting together a panel of experts to give us advice, and we want to share your stories and questions with them. So record a short voice memo, no more than a few minutes long, and tell us if there's something you're afraid of and if you could use some advice about how to be brave. Email it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Margot Price was in her mid-20s and still very much trying to scrape together a music career when she and her husband learned they were having twins. Then they discovered in a routine scan there was a problem.
Those conversations were the most difficult of my life. I mean, me trying to explain what the doctor said to me as I was still processing it was almost impossible. It was almost like they had, you know, prepared me at that moment for his death. And I was only, about 17 or 18 weeks pregnant. And he kept trying to calm me down and say, like, it can't be that bad. We'll go get a second opinion or, whatever he was trying to say to me. But I knew that it was a very serious diagnosis. And, they gave me a bunch of pamphlets and the doctor came into the room and, he said that he was immediately going to have surgery after his birth, and that if he did make it through these first surgeries in his young life, that he would only live to be 30. And that was the part of the conversation that was just the most difficult to swallow. I just, thought, how do you explain to your child they probably won't live past 30. I didn't want him to have to go through that.
When you think back on those those first days after you gave birth to your twins. You have one twin who you're able to hold and breastfeed, and another child that's in the NICU preparing for surgery, and you've just gone through C-section, this major surgery. Like, what do your memories look like, hazy? Like, how do you, when you think back on that and where your mind was, like, what, how many ways did your attention feel divided?
Oh, yeah. It was, one of the most painful times in my life. And I was just not even able to kind of comprehend everything that was going on. It all just, it didn't seem real. It seemed like I had kind of like woke up in this like warped reality where, you know, it sounds cliche, but it was just this nightmare that you could not wake up from. And there was a lot of shame and a lot of me thinking that it was something that I did, that it was my fault, and that I was being punished. But it was almost just like I was just numb. And then when they told me that he didn't make it through the surgery, this was, 11, 12 days after, that was when it was almost like I woke up then, and I just could not cope with anything anymore. And, just came back to the house, and my sisters took care of our surviving son, and just absolutely, wanted to shut everything off. It was just too hard. And then that was, just the start of kind of pushing everything aside and not going to therapy, because only damaged, crazy people went to therapy.
Wait, who taught you that?
Oh, just society.
Everyone.
My small town. Yeah. Everybody. Yeah. So I wish that I would have dealt with things in real time, but I was nowhere near capable. I just didn't have the tools.
Catastrophe that is yours and mine. They say it takes time to become timeless. Time is all I've got this time. Once in a while.
How do you talk about your son Ezra with his brother Judah, with your daughter Ramona, who's much younger? How do you talk about that as a family?
Well, we always just kind of told Judah from the very start, like before he was even big enough to comprehend, we would say, we had a photo album, and we would say, this is your brother. You were twins. You were in mommy's tummy at the same time, but Ezra died, and that was just kind of it, And so it was kind of, we didn't want it to come as a shock when he was like a teenager or something, because we knew that he was probably already feeling that loss. He was deeply bonded as twins can be. We knew that he was feeling it, whether or not he knew what he was experiencing. And recently, actually, it was just last week, I was going through an old china cabinet that belonged to my grandmother, and I had a bunch of things in there, and I had the photo of the two of them framed, and it was just hiding in this china cabinet because I could not look at it. and just not feel angry and not feel sad. And so just last week I hung it up on the wall, and my daughter Ramona, she saw it, and she was pointing to all the photos and saying, "Who is this?" And you know, she's 3 and a half, but I said, "Well, that's your brother, and you know, hopefully we'll meet him someday." But I usually don't get too choked up about this anymore, but it's sometimes it just hits you.
Yeah, you just pulled the photo out and put it on the wall, Margo. You're not hiding it.
Yeah, it only took me 12 and a half years.
Won't you tell me how long must I pay all these dues? Won't you tell me when I learn to said it, oh, but say that it's not true. Is when we learn to lose.
Margo co-wrote this song, "Learning to Lose," with her husband Jeremy. That it became a duet with Willie Nelson shows how spectacularly Margo's fortune shifted when she was signed by Jack White's record company in 2015. Her son Judah was school age by then. Before that, there were years of patching together gigs, rent money, and crash pads on the road. For a lot of that time, Margo and Jeremy played in a band together called Buffalo Clover, until Margo started sleeping with their guitar player, who was also married. She writes in her book, "We were like Fleetwood Mac without any of the success." In your memoir, you wrote about after the death of your son, an affair you had, and you described it. And it's something that you had disclosed to your husband years ago. But I wonder, like, what's it? How often does that come back up? And did writing about it again force new conversations or revisiting conversations that you thought you'd gone through?
Yeah, a bit. I think a lot of people were shocked when they heard that Jeremy was, you know, kind of not only just okay with me sharing those kinds of personal details about our marriage, but that he encouraged me to be really transparent about what we went through, because I think up until just recently, I think a lot of our peers and a lot of our acquaintances and people on the outside probably were just looking at our relationship and saying like, "Oh, wow, you guys have such a perfect marriage and you just support each other through everything." And it was a lot of it was due to how often and how much I was drinking. And, I think that he has forgiven me, but it's harder for me to forgive myself. We did end up kind of talking about it when we went into therapy together, because it was just something that, you know, we did work through, but it's my biggest regret. I wish that I could take that back. But I am really grateful that he has showed me He actually just popped his head in here and asked if I wanted, if you should go pick up the kids.
I said,
no, I will. But yeah, I think, you know, it's something that's, it's there and it can be a little bit of a, difficult hurdle to work through, but it's not as turbulent as it used to be. I mean, there's, we have taken off the divorce word from the table. It's like, you know what? Let's just not threaten each other with that because we know we're not going to do it.
When did that happen? When did you say, let's stop threatening this?
I think it was only about 9 months ago. You know, we've went through a little bit of a tumultuous time with me quitting drinking. We have had more fights since I quit drinking, than we have in a long time. Uh-huh. It's, I mean, you know, friendships have dissolved. There's people that I used to spend time with that I just don't anymore. And then there's other people that I've kept my friendships with and they still drink and it doesn't feel weird because, well, I don't live with them. I don't sleep with them. I think with Jeremy and I, it's just that we are so used to doing every single thing together. Like, you know, BFFs, like if I'm doing something, like he's there with me. And with eradicating alcohol from my life, I've realized like this is a solo journey and like you're in it on your own. I mean, of course it's nice when you can have a buddy, I'm sure, to quit with, and like, you know, couples that quit together, like I'm sure that's really wonderful. But I've done the growth on my own, and it, you know, I've ultimately had to realize that like even though I have been in this partnership for half of my life, I am still my own person. And it's been the best decision I've ever made. I had this woman who's quite a bit older than me. Her name is Kathy, and she is in this death metal band called The Great Sadness.
Oh. I want to rock to some Kathy music. That sounds perfect.
Kathy is like in her 60s, and she actually played the devil in my music video for Went to the Mountain.
Amazing.
We got to talking, and she just turned to me and, you know, she's like, so what's your story? What's your deal? And, you know, I started kind of giving her the cliff notes of my memoir and whatever. And she goes, I've been sober for 26 years. Sobriety ain't for pussies. And I just was looking at her and I was like, you are the coolest, most beautiful, unapologetic person I have ever met. And I want to be just like you when I grow up. Hell yeah. That's where I want to be.
That's Margot Price. Her latest album is called Strays. And her memoir is titled Maybe We'll Make It. You can see a list of all of her songs that you heard in this episode on our website at deathsexmoney.org. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Andrew Dunn. The rest of our team is Afi Yellowduke, Zoe Azoulay, Liliana Maria Percy-Ruiz, and Lindsay Foster-Thomas. Our intern is Baze Hohen. The Reverend John DeLure and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Instagram at Anna Sale Pix. That's P-I-C-S. And the show is at Death, Sex, Money on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you to Molly McCullough from Baltimore, Maryland, for being a member of Death, Sex, and Money and supporting us with a monthly donation. Join Molly and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. And speaking of money, Margot's now on the board of Farm Aid, the group Willie Nelson and others started during the 80s farm crisis to support families like Margot's who were losing their farms. She and Willie have become friends and play together a lot, and she's nonchalant about it. In a way, I would not be.
On my wall, I have a lot of family pictures, you know, all happy photos. It's like both of my kids sitting on Willie Nelson's lap.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
How large is it? Does it take up a whole wall?
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.